podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Attacking Scrum. It's a special commemorate the international series against against South Africa. The sound you can hear in the background there is the Mighty Murph clearing out the last bit of Glastonbury from his throat. We've dragged him back and put him through a rigorous training regime this week to get him up to match fitness. And here he is in all his glory. How are you doing, Murph?
Good, yeah. I stopped feeling knackered on Thursday, so... having come back Sunday night, so I don't know how much weight I lost, because obviously the steps were ridiculous. You know, yeah. I'm not one for counting my steps every day, but they were. Everyone was talking about all their steps are through the roof, and I don't know if it's just me, but there seems to be less food stalls at Glastonbury than ever.
Oh, really?
So every time you wanted to eat, you had to be really committed to eating, if you know what I mean, because it was just a long queue all the time. So I skipped quite a few meals as well as walking all day and all night. I'm not the type who weighs myself all the time, but I must have shifted a little bit of timber on that weekend.
Well, match fit. Just that bit definitely. Leaner, that extra yard of pace off the base of the ruck.
It's a yard of pace and... take about 10, 15 years off and I'm ready.
Mate, I talk about taking 10 or 15 years off. That game's put 10 or 15 years on me, I think, which we are definitely going to get into. I was impressed that you cycled to Glastonbury as well. Well, you know, not from Cardiff, it has to be said, but impressive nonetheless. And
It seemed like a good idea at the time. Do you know what it was? What started it was? People who go will know, obviously the tickets... what it is fairly expensive, but to leave your car in a overgrown lumpy field, they charge you £50 just to, you know, park, and that's, you know, serious profit, because there's thousands and thousands of cars. And I just thought, stuff it, I'm not going to take my car, I'm going to cycle and save myself £50, £200 worth of kit later to fit on my bike.
That's it, net loss of £150.
Yeah, but you know, I've got that kit forever now, so it was great. It was a very chilled way to arrive. You're normally sort of in the crush all the way down in the car, and then you're lugging all your shite from the vehicle to the site and all that. But the bike lockup is fairly far into the site, and you just jump off and off you go. So it was a very chilled out. I wasn't in any traffic. I was just going through farmers' areas. God knows where I was, because I was just sort of sat nav from my mate's place. So it was a nice chilled out way to arrive. I didn't cope with it so well on the way home, obviously, but that's another story.
Yeah, getting off and pushing it up the hill.
Yeah.
But good for you. So you get a special campsite with a shower in it if you turn up on a bike.
Yeah, there's a cyclist field. But most people, you take their bike in and then just camp with their mates anyway, because it's whatever. But if you're committed, you can go in this separate field, and it's got like solar showers in there and stuff. And there was no temperature set in mind on the shower, so I will be right into Mr. Evis.
That's it. I don't know. Maybe if I get a ticket for next year, I'll knock a cyclist off his bike a mile away and pinch that in.
Well, it's much easier to cycle down than it is to get a bloody... Yeah, I've lost you, mate.
We're back. Sorry, that was me. I was trying to move my laptop and we lost connection momentarily. That feels like a good point to move on to some rugby. Niceties out the way, Murph. let's get down to the Patreon special for Murph's Glasgow experience. That'll be coming up at some point. But let's get down to the nitty gritty. An astonishing test match. And we've got lots of listeners' questions coming in, which we're going to dive into. The reason I moved my laptop, this shows the level of professionalism that the show is because I've got my mic obscuring the Twitter feed here in front of me, so I can't actually see. So I have to reach into my pocket and get the phone out. I thought I was being really prepared by having that up, but obviously that failed massively. Right, let's get stuck in to. All right, let's go to this one because I think this actually sums it up quite nicely. So Gary Mason, I know, long time listener of the show. Do you think this is going to be the high point of the tour?
Yeah, that's a good question, isn't it? Because it's fairly general. The general consensus is that we've caught them cold, having not played in a long time. We played obviously in March, April. So yeah, and although we played really well, they posed no threat or very little threat behind in that game, and it's hard to imagine them being that pedestrian again in this series. But it could just have been our tactics or the way we defended or the way we approached the game yesterday is why they couldn't get going. But you'd imagine there'll be a reaction, in the next couple of tests. The good thing is we've got the hard venue out of the way.
No, that's true. Yeah,
So
that's true. Yeah. Oh, yeah. The nice, easy trip to Bloemfontein next.
yeah, but quite often, you're 2-0 down in the series, or say in
That's
Alliance,
true.
and next thing you're playing in Loftus, trying to get some salvage some respect out of the series. Like, so we got the hard one out of the way, and it was gone, much better than anyone apart from. There was a few, wasn't there, dotted around the internet, like Paul Williams and what have you, were calling that Wales would be competitive in this series, and everyone was laughing at him. And there was one or two others who called it as well. But generally speaking, no one saw yesterday coming.
No, I certainly didn't. I think you're absolutely right. The consensus was that we'd probably be on to a stuffing. It certainly wasn't that, last kick of the game. You've got to look at it as a missed opportunity, though, I think. And this is not me, obviously we've been critical of PIVAC's team selections and their performances in recent times. And this isn't just PIVAC bashing, but I think you have got to look at it as a missed opportunity because one, have you ever seen a South African halfback pairing play as badly as de Klerk and Jantjies did in that first, or Jantjies in that first half?
Yeah.
I mean, de Klerk had some good touches, points in the second half, but he looked way off colour compared to what he's normally
Well,
like.
he was spaffing it. I mean, he's probably the best box kicker, scrum half wise, in the world, and he was spaffing it into touch. And even in the second half, when he was playing better, he was still knocking bad kicks into touch, direct into touch, I mean, that was, we've never won, obviously, never won a game in South Africa, and that's the closest we've ever come. And how long will it be? How long will we have to wait? That's the trouble when you, obviously, we've got the same record in New Zealand, the same record in Australia. I don't think we've run a test in Australia either, have we? We've come
No.
close in Australia.
I'm thinking that I don't know.
Terrible record, anyway, either way. It's
Terrible
terrible.
record, absolutely.
And when you get these ones where you've played really well and they just fall short, they're the ones that you've got to grab because, as we know as Welsh fans, is around the corner, there's always likely to be a drubbing away in June or July. So.
To come back to that point of whether it's Wales turning the corner or catching South Africa cold. Something I will say that I thought was, certainly encouraging was after would this have been the maybe after the penalty try, and then Wales were down to 12 or 13 and 12 momentarily, and they got the penalty and the Dowie Lake try. I thought that genuinely was a moment of, I think that it would be very easy to let your head sink at that point and go, right, we're not getting anything out of this game, we've given it a good try, it'd be better. But they rolled and went again, and it's to see Dan Biggar miss a conversion like that. It wasn't a tap in, but for him, for a goal kicker of his standard, he'd normally nudge those over. But for that and the penalty at the end, they've done it. They've done it the hard way. So I don't know. I think the spirit that they showed at that point was definitely something that we didn't see that I didn't see that at all in the Six Nations, if I'm honest.
No, I mean the bit you've covered there. That there's so much to dig into on that, like the going behind, having been 15 points in front, and then to come back and score a driven line out try against South Africa. First of all, I love slagging off coaches, but credit to the forwards coach on that one. I know we're obviously going to come to it later, but when we scored that try. Normally, I would go on, lads, or whatever. Come on, Wales, whatever. what I was actually, the first thing, I obviously bounced off my sofa. First thing I said was, fuck you, ref. I'm afraid that is the first word that came out of my mouth.
Which brings us brilliantly.
Well, I'm not finished.
No, it's good. I just want to acknowledge people who said, can we have Murph have a rant about the referee, please?
You can have it. I mean, we're back. I mean, it feels like bloody Groundhog Day. We're in a situation where we're analysing a Welsh game, and it's not all about, but a massive feature of it again is shitty calls, or being on the end of shitty calls from the ref.
Which ones in particular were your highlights, Murph?
I suppose the biggest one, which is getting a lot of attention since, is Lewis Rees-Sammet's yellow, because it was a great piece of defending with a beautiful clean tackle, clear release, and then Jackal to win the ball. Should have been penalty to us. We end up with a man off a pitch. Dan Biggers was dubious.
I think that's a pen.
Pen, yeah. If you want to give a pen, give a pen. Other teams get away with it, by the way. Other teams get away with that all the time. Pen, fine. I mean, in a way, to South Africa, so penalty, fine. Never saw the actual... maybe it was clear-cut, and I just didn't spot it, but Alamein Jones's yellow, we couldn't really see, apart from being offside like nearly every international side in the world. I couldn't really see what had happened there. And then you could have picked for, I suppose, once you give a penalty try, you've got to give a yellow. But he could have picked anyone in that defending mall at the end. So we should have had two, for sure. We ended up with four, or was it more than that? I mean, Dan Bigger could have been three off at one point. Yeah, I think it was four in total. Dan Bigger could have been on a second yellow card at the end for the penalty, which resulted in them winning the game because that was a deliberate knockdown. So he could have been on a red card. He didn't bother giving that because I think he was... Dan Bigger has had a mental game, by the way. Just going back on your coverage there, started the game brilliantly, defensively. The Lewis Rees-Sammet try, the first Lewis Rees-Sammet try, is everything I want to see Wales do. Just slick hands under pressure. Every single player had someone in their face, and they still managed to throw an accurate pass to their mate. And that's why the quickest guy around got the ball in space and finished it off. And it was lush. Then Danley just chipped over a pitching wedge from miles away from a drop goal. Was quite rightly... Bigger, arguing with the ref.
Not Lydiot. Yeah.
Sorry?
Bigger, not Lydiot. But yeah.
What did I say? Oh, the chip. Oh, yeah.
It would have been nice. It would have been nice to see Lydiot.
I'm getting excited.
But do you know what the frustrating thing is? Sorry to jump in, Murph. But you're right. He had an amazing game. And the frustrating thing is that you look at it at the end and it's two mistakes that...
That's what I was coming to. Yeah. He's been brilliant all game. And he's quite rightly in the ref's face because he was all over us. The ref's warming all over us. And then at the death... He's still being great, playing his part in everything that we're doing well. And then in the last 3 minutes, he misses a conversion. I mean, conversions can be missed, and then gives away the penalty that wins them the game. So he's just done everything, really, all in one match. What I think stood out amongst all that, on top of all that, is how much the crowd hated him. The crowd booed every single time he was on the ball, every time he was kicking into touch, every time he was lining up a place kick, every time he was talking to the ref, just booed, worse than he would be at, say, Twickenham. I don't know why he's so unpopular in South Africa as opposed to other countries.
I think that's just South African fans I think that's probably that occasion he's got under their nose, and they really go for it when they do. I think we mentioned last year, several times you mentioned last year during the Lions tour, how flat it was because there were no fans in there.
That's not just
the Lions fans in there, it's the South African fans, which makes it so much more heated. Because there's a point on there where I was like, even if this wasn't us playing, I just want someone to stick one on these South African fans because they drive you mad. Which again is the beauty of it. That's why we love sport, is those completely irrational moments. You're absolutely right. And a long way throughout the game, I was thinking, God, South Africa, what would South Africa give to have Dan Bigger at 10 today? You know, it's just someone who can control the game and that's what he did for large chunks of it. But yeah, absolutely on your point about the first try. Even before it got to the backs, what set it up was that alertness. So, you know, Roland squandered it. Gareth Thomas was onto the loose ball. Roland straight away after him, popped inside. Kieran Hardy's there. It's recycled quickly and it's away. And that was, you know, I know it's a try for turnover, but that was a great try. And that's the stuff that's really, really encouraging, because we hadn't looked like doing anything like that all season.
At one stage, I think I've said on here, one stage in the spring, no team in the country looked like they could string a ball accurately across the back line. And yeah, that, you know, that is the most basic part of any back's job, is to be able to fling the ball across the bloody back line. And the senior sides, the internationals, the regional, the under-20s, none of them look capable of throwing a ball at speed across a back line like professional rugby's players should be able to do. And yesterday was the first time we've seen it this calendar year, at least. And then, you know, that's why you have people like Lewis Rees-Sammet on the wing, because when they get given space like that, it's all over. We were up against Cheslin Kolbe and Mapimpi, and we didn't see him apart from the one try Kolbe scored, but that was just a walk in, having been battered up front for half an hour. Essentially,
there was that, you know, it wasn't that break kind of deep into the second half from Kolbe as well, where he looked, because they seemed to be running into dead ends quite a lot actually, and then Kolbe managed to do Cheslin Kolbe things and found some space out of nowhere. But yeah, you're absolutely right. It's
you know, and the best centre partnership in the world was kept quiet. Yeah. You know, it's balmy. The more you think about it, the more mad that game was. Just going back briefly to Will Rowlands, it seems to be like a acknowledgement around the way that he's retired, Alan Wynn.
Do you think retired?
Well, taking his position and left him being a support act for the remainder of his playing days, essentially. If Will Rowlands carries playing like this, then you can't drop him.
You're absolutely right. And actually, there's quite a lot of talk about the lock position, which we're going to come on to.
I'm not comfortable with it, but that's...
Well, yeah, this one's come in from Jake. It says, is Alan Wynn a starter for Wales anymore? Should Rowlands be there in his place and have a succession plan on the go? I mean, from my point of view, you can't. And that's what was so strange about the Italy game, is we all know, you know, what Alan Wynn's done for Wales. As we've said a million times, he's probably the greatest ever player. And certainly in the modern areas, but it was really strange to drop Rowlands for that Italy game, because he was in the form of his life and he was absolutely massive again yesterday. I think that is Wales' best second row partnership at the moment, and you know, things can change for sure, but right now you go absolutely same again next week.
Personal attachment aside, it's depth. You know, if someone like Alan Wynn can't get into the starting 15, then that means we're going all right. You know what I mean? There was a time, I know he's late vintage Alan Wynn, so it's different. But there was a time you couldn't imagine the second row without him in it. So the way Will Rowlands has grown over the last season or so, I mean, he was good when he arrived, don't get me wrong, but this... I don't know, last eight or 9 months, he's just got better all the time. And I mean, I don't know. Will's not young, is he? Late 20s?
No, I want to say 28, something like that.
But, you know, if Adam Beard was a different type of second row, less of a telegraph pole, it would be him was under pressure. But he's our specialist lineout forward. South Africa were marking Adam Beard out of the lineout, so we would have to throw elsewhere all the time. And that's a good sign that he's marked.
It is a good sign, and also defensively, massive hats off for the way they defended the. I know they got their tries from that in the end, but bloody hell, there were points where I was like, "How long is the ref going to give this driving line out to get going when South Africa had it?" Because Wales defended really well to start with defensively, and that's so hard, especially against that side. No side in the world does driving line outs as well as South Africa. No. And I thought they did that really, really well, that whole defensive bit. So hats off for that. And actually, again, you know, look, credit where it's due to Pivac. He's the one who identified Rowlands right at the start of his tenure, you know, and bought him in. I know he'd had his eye on him, I think, when he was at Scarlett's and knew he was Welsh qualified, and you know that's turned out to be a really important. It turned out to be a really important
for Wales. I, you know, as we know, I'm quite happy for Wayne to have been pushed out after the Italy game, but. He's got a team together today, this weekend, yesterday. And that performance probably means he's not going to lose his job.
Well, that's a good point, actually. This question is coming from Paddy Gilling, who says, I'm sure he won't have mentioned it, but what does Murph think of the referee, which I think we've covered, and I'm sure we'll come back to. But he also says, how much does that performance shore up Pivac?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, especially if we continue in the same vein for the next two games, then there's no question. Then aside from anything else, it's much cheaper for the union to keep hold of him. So, you know, if they continue to play like this, I think there's trouble coming because we were getting away with it in the scrum. You know, we picked our weakest scrum to start the game against South Africa yesterday and on the whole managed to get away with it. But I don't think South Africa are aware of that much longer. You know, when you got Mal Herbert and Oxenche, eventually they're going to just say, no, keep it in the scrum, keep it in the scrum, keep it in the scrum until we're in bits. So, yeah, I think there might be trouble coming, especially because I hope Tom Francis has been sent home after being knocked out again yesterday.
We will definitely come on to that in the second half. Just quickly on the Pivac thing before we have a break, I think that it's one of those where realistically this would have been much better for him if it was a one match series. You know, if you go home after that, you know what I mean, if it was a one off test and you go home after that, go, God, yeah, do you know, that's something to build on, given the Springboks a bloody nose, everyone goes off, has a good break over the summer, back to club rugby, then into the autumn, we go, right, we have to pick up where we left off. Whereas I can see, I don't want to be the prophet of doom, but like you say, you can see a backlash from the Springboks because they're not used to getting run that close. And they shouldn't have been. I thought they were dire at points. And I can see them getting a kick in. And if they sort themselves out, like you say, it could be that they just grind you down. And they're dirty, dirty side as well.
Yeah.
Like, you know, within, you know, you know what I mean. Within, you know, there was nothing sight worthy in that game, I don't think. But they're aggressive and they're aggro and they can really wind sides up. And
yeah,
I can see a drubbing at some point in this tour. But you're right, you know, maybe this is it. Maybe the players will grow in stature off the back of that and go, right, this is a side that can run the best in the world close on their own patch.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope it goes that way. What are you saying about the South African players there? It's the shoving and the squaring up and expecting the opposition to back down in that situation and expecting the referee to make them back down in that situation. I'm all for aggressive rugby playing, but it's the entitlement in their credo kind of thing that they're going to shove you and you're expected to back down and the referee is expected to support that. And, you know, that's the way it looks when you're watching on TV, and that really winds me up. That makes me wish, you know, I had like a voodoo doll of Cheslin Colby in the dead ball area shoving Dan Biggar around. Like, I know, look, different eras, different generations. I can't remember who else. It was Bigger and was it Josh Allen?
Bigger North, I think.
Just slapped him all over the pitch for that. And then obviously all their players would have had to storm in after. But you don't. It's because, quite rightly, you can't punch everyone anymore. It's become more of a soccer type scenario where it's just more like a dick measuring contest than an actual fight, do you know what I mean? Just like egos looking at each other. There's no actual violence involved, though. But he's shoving Dan Biggar in the dead ball area. That'd have kicked him stupid in the 1990s on a Parks pitch in Cardiff. I can tell you that for nothing.
Well, I think that'll be the slogan for this podcast. I'd have kicked him stupid in a Park game in the 90s.
He dropped him and everything. Cheeky little fucker. if I could catch him, obviously. Different colour fish.
So time for a quick break and for us all to regroup after that wonderful insight into the way that our immersed mind works.
Right,
we'll be back with some more listeners' questions my hot take on the Dragons rebrand, which I know our fans are desperate to hear of, and I know Murph is desperate for. I think he's gonna walk off when I start talking about that.
I'm just going back to a session with my shrink now instead.
Right, we'll be back in 1 second. Right, time for some more listeners' questions, Murph. Into the second half, I found this very therapeutic, actually. I think it would have been much worse if I had to deal with that defeat and not have you as a metaphorical shoulder to cry on. Before we get on to more questions, I had an absolute shocker trying to watch the game. So I was actually in Cardiff this weekend for my niece's christening.
Right.
And the christening finished by... Yeah, it was finished by like 1:30. It was great, and then we went down to Rubina Rugby Club for the there's a bowls club and a tennis club and the rugby
yeah
club
the rec yeah, yeah,
side,
yeah
the
yeah,
rec yeah. Yeah, yeah and we went down there for like a little do afterwards, and I thought, well, this would be all right, I'm staying here guaranteed to have the game on, but then by the time we got to 4, my kids were just starting to lose patience completely. I thought, oh, there's no way I'm gonna be able to watch the whole game here, so watch the first 15 minutes. And then drove back to my mum's in Bristol, and thought, well, that's all right. I'll avoid the result. Watch it tonight. We'll be travelling. I have the radio off. Just do a likely lads. Avoid the result and watch it. Didn't check my phone. Nothing. And then when it went to go and watch the games, not on Sky. My mum hasn't got Sky, so I've logged into my Sky Plus. Not on there. Haven't uploaded it yet. I was like, oh, God's sake. I'm like, I can't Google a full live stream of it because you just get the result.
Yeah.
So I kept going back to Sky like every half an hour and seeing. Anyway, I gave up at 11 o'clock. I was like, right, it's obviously not on here.
Next day?
So the next day you didn't know the result? So today, Sunday, I avoided it still.
Well played.
I've still not checked my phone, hence not phoning you this morning to check you're still on for tonight.
Yeah.
And I was like, right, just won't check my phone at all. Because someone will have ruined it for me.
Yeah.
And so, no social media, no nothing. And have then driven from Bristol back down the M4 to here in Guildford, avoided it, and then got to 4 o'clock today, watched the game in full.
Well done.
As live. It was even more agonising, I would say, having been through all of that to avoid the game to then
I think if we'd won that game yesterday afternoon, which obviously we nearly did, you would have feared.
Yeah, you're right.
You would have feared by today. So,
yeah. But even then, I had I can't remember why, but I got a text message come through, and so, like, I just glanced my phone and then looked away, and I saw it from the WRU, and I was like, oh, well, we must have won then. I was like, I bet we've won, because they wouldn't be contacting you for any other reason than to try and shift tickets off the back of a good performance. But anyway, yeah, it's sure enough, they are. But anyway, there we go. Let's get down to the listeners' questions again. And do you know what? Let's take a serious one there. So this one's come from Progressive Rugby, who obviously, you know, we talk about quite a lot on this pod, and they tweet us every now and again. With the obvious caveat that you can't see Thomas France's medical records, do you think most fans would want him to return home for a prolonged rest prior to the next season following his latest concussion?
Yeah, I do, but I don't think it should be up to the fans to pressure anyone. It should just be the welfare of the player taken into consideration now. I mean, we're going to be Dylan Lewis and a couple of youngsters, I think, left in the squad if Tom goes home, but I don't know what you can do. I mean, it was bad technique on his part. He had his head on the wrong side of someone's leg, and that's why he got... It was Kitsoff's leg, yeah. I mean, even with Kitsoff, and even on the right side, it's going to hurt. But you get your head jammed between his leg and your shoulder, and he was out, you know, completely out. Looked like he'd been shot. And it's too many in a season for him, really, isn't it? And there's just no... You know, there's a World Cup. We're on a cycle of a World Cup. It would come around in no time. There's just no point. Well, to me, say if all protocols and everything's going perfectly for him since that incident, he still can't play next week because he's been out. So, in 7 days' time, you can't play again having been out called on this match. So he's only going to be there, even if everything goes really well, he's only going to be there for the third test. And by then, we'd have blooded these unknowns we've taken out with us, only, you know, we've only done it because we've taken them because we've had to. But I just, for the sake of the last game of the series, can't see any point in him staying on the tour.
Well, yeah, and more so, I just, you, look, you're right, it's not even just about, oh, the World Cup's around the corner, you've got to look after him. It's just like, you see these collisions happen, and you just go, no good can come from him playing. It just can't, you know, for his own long-term health,
yeah. No
good can come from it. And look, I have no medical experience or knowledge whatsoever, but just take him out of that scenario and get home and do whatever you can to sit it out.
Well, if you're in a, it's been well documented with people like Shontayne Harpe and different things. Rob Baxter, I think, was one, and also Joe Worsley. They had too many concussions, and then your brain or your head becomes sensitive to anything, and even a glance across your face can pull you out. So accumulated concussions can mean you go out much easier. That's why, you know, boxers seem to fight less than ever now, because they got that long period of recovery between each fight. Same goes for mixed martial artists. If they actually get knocked out in a fight, they have a long break before they go back to any contact training and certainly any competitive bouts. And that's the way we've got to start, you know, there's still this certain type of person on Twitter who's saying we used to carry on in my day and the game's gone soft and all that shit. But you know, that if you look at the history of contact sports and boxing, when fighters used to do multiple bouts per year, going back decades, they all ended up, you know, almost all of them ended up mentally impaired in their old age. And that's what we've come to realize in recent years. And if someone like Tom Francis has got a habit of getting himself knocked out all the time in the pitch, he's just got to take a break. I mean, there's loads of players in the system. Rhys Patchell's done it. George North has done it. He just can't seem to keep their head out of trouble. And every time they have a glance, they're out cold. So when you're in that cycle, I just think, I don't know. I don't know if you can put any hard and fast rules on it, you know, in terms of time, but I just think you just got to take Tom out until September at least.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. And do you know what? I think the most important point you've made there is really it's nothing to do with the fans, is it? Like this is something that just has to be, you know, it's fine us, you know, we're just a pair of fans and we got our opinion on it. I think our point is do what is medically right. You know, do what is right to recover in the, you know, in the short and the long term. And that's, you know, that stuff that is or should be governed by a doctor's opinion and you know, listening to the science on it rather than you know what it was like in my day in inverted commas.
Yeah, well, all the signs are there with Tom Francis, who's got a problem, because you know there's other instances where he would have had knocks in the past which wouldn't do that.
The one against England was particularly bad, wasn't it?
Yeah, but what I mean is there's others where he would have had bad knocks and it wouldn't have knocked him out. It seems to be glancing blows and he's totally asleep. So that suggests there's an accumulative problem in it going on with his head, and he needs to be assessed the fuck out of, if that's a technical term for it, and looked at very carefully before he goes back into contact again.
I'm pretty sure that's what the doctors say.
Yeah, it's on. It'd be on his notepad now. That's why their handwriting's so bad. So you can't see those kind of comments.
Exactly. Let's take this one from Rugby 24/7. Do you know what? This guy has actually tweeted us before and he told me his name, so I'm going to go back and check. Neil, that's it. So Neil at Rugby 24/7. What are your thoughts on Thomas Williams kicking the ball away with 20 seconds left on the clock? Right intentions or just poor game management?
One of my mates had a rant about that on WhatsApp, but I just think there was nothing left in the tank for our boys. We were still, I think, on 13 players at the time.
Yeah, 13.
And you know, what can you do? You're looking around for someone with the energy to... the only criticism that did land with me was he shouldn't have gone for length. He should have gone for a contestable again.
But yeah, I think Jamie Roberts said that in commentary, didn't he? Or he certainly said it at some point.
Yeah.
That actually it was a tactic that had worked well. You know, the box kick had gone well. Hardy, to be fair.
But contestable ones are working well.
Absolutely.
And maybe, you know, with the altitude, Thomas thought he was going to get it right up to the try line or whatever. but it didn't go well for us. But then, you know, I just felt we weren't going to have the energy to play out 90 seconds, not against those big gets, you know what I mean? And it was going to have to be kicked eventually. And then the other way would be for every back to come in and just play with a blanket over you.
I know, but you know what happens in that.
Yeah, we get turned
over. How many times you've seen it? You get turned over, or you give away a penalty for sealing off.
Yeah.
It happens so often.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like that when that intent is there, that you know you're just trying to play the game out.
Yeah.
Someone is going to give away a penalty. And I think the referees' senses are heightened to it because they know all they've got to look for.
Yeah.
That all they've got to look for is sealing off.
Yeah. Because the team in possession don't really want to do anything with it other than just go from collateral to collateral and run the clock down, so they get more harsh on the breakdown. But I mean, we've got form for it in this country. Like Mike Phillips kicking the ball away in a game in Australia, I think might have been another country, which was he shouldn't have kicked, and also to compound the issue, it was an absolutely shit kick as well. And we ended up losing. That might have been at home. There's another one of Priestland ended up kicking a ball away in a game where we were hanging on to beat a Tri-Nations side. So we've got form for it, you know, plenty of it over the past years. But on this occasion, when you've got so many players... The other thing with this amount of sin bins is we didn't see a lot of the bench players. Like Anscombe never got on. I didn't notice when Josh Adams went off. It ended up with Owen Watkin on the pitch.
Owen Watkin was on, yeah.
So we didn't even get the opportunity to use our bench. Obviously, Dylan Lewis went off and had to come back again after about 5 minutes. So there was a lack of fresh legs and a lot of tired bodies. You're defending with 13 or even 12 men at stages. So I don't know what option. Even if he'd gone for a contestable kick, was there any legs left to chase it? You know, so it was we were a bit of a busted flush at that stage, and we needed South Africa to implode, if you know what I mean. I think we should take heart in the fact that they had to just bludgeon their way through with a driven line out. Their driven line out had been faulty on the day, they would have lost that game, because they didn't look like scoring behind.
Do they ever do anything else? I think we moaned all last summer, didn't we? That
oh yeah, but they
the whole time kicking the ball in the air
I mean, the worst.
They got the best winger in the world.
The worst series of rugby I've ever seen. But since then, in the autumn, they played some rugby, and they, more importantly, their provincial sides or whatever they are, named after animals teams, do play a lot of rugby and good rugby as well. So it's in them. And they have, you know, like I say, since the Lions series last year, they have played rugby. But I don't know. You'd expect to see their boys in full flow at the High Veld, wouldn't you? It just didn't. And I think we give credit to our team for that.
Yes. No, actually, because that's true. As much as you say that Wales, you know, when did we play? March last, right?
Wales
played in March. And we lost to Italy, which is hardly ideal preparation, is it?
No.
And then we've had a lot of players off injured. And
we've had a big rest, mind, because all our regional sides are so shite, they didn't qualify for any end-of-season stuff.
That's absolutely true. Yeah, no, that's a good point, actually. Yeah. But I don't know. You know, I hardly see that as a massive advantage.
No.
You know, I think they've been caught cold, because if I'm honest, I don't think South Africa expected much. And they looked really, really. They did look short of a game, but they were really poor with it in the first half. Like that's like woefully poor.
Well, they wouldn't have expected much on the back of playing against our regional sides.
No, they wouldn't.
You know, they're playing them in the domestic season now, and I think, well, there's not a lot to worry about this afternoon with this crowd. So,
yeah, because none of the regional sides ran any South African side close on home on their patch. Well, none of the good South African sides anyway. You know, there was nothing where you looked at it and went, unless I'm completely forgetting, which is entirely possible. My memory of those games, it was so one-sided on their patch.
Yeah, there
so,
wasn't yeah, even any close right. scores, was there? You know,
I don't think so.
Apart from the weak side, the Lions, is it? You know, it was all our sides were conceded 40 points plus down there. So that might be some of the reason why they're a little bit complacent. But I tend not to think it's them underperforming as such, and just us playing really well. I'm determined to say positive, referee aside.
No, I think it's somewhere in between.
Yeah,
you can't say Wales didn't play well, because I think it was the spirit. You know, as much as anything, they came out really up for it.
Yeah,
the most up for it I've seen.
Well, the defending, the defending was epic. You know, Tommy Rafael, I mean, he's been really good.
Can we settle this?
Yeah,
Rafael or Raffle? Because I've always called him Tommy Raffle, and Tommy Rafael to me, as Martin Gillingham said on commentary all day, he sounds like he should be a character from like Mitchell and Webb or something. Like he's, you know, some failed actor who's trying to do something. You know, it's Rafael, darling.
Tommy
it's
Cockles. if we want to go the, you know, the real Welsh route with him, we call him Tommy Rafael. But I mean, you know, look, we've talked about him, haven't we? And he's been really good for Leicester, but he's been, you know, he's clearly a good player, but he's been outstanding. He's been one of Leicester's best players this season. And again, a little bit like, I guess, Navidi, when he came on the scene, everyone thought he was just a great club player. And then you put him on an international stage and you realise he's a god. And that looks, based on one game, that looks like what Tommy is. He looks just godlike in a Welsh shirt. Like even Sia Khaleesi was chatting to him at length after the game because of the way he played. So
it wasn't just like kind of eye-catching stuff either, was it? It was just the amount of work that he got through. And it's not just, you know, because there's some good turnover work in there as well, but it's just the nuisance work, you know, and the scramble defence I thought was brilliant yesterday from the whole team. You know, there was a cover tackle from, obviously you mentioned the Lewis Rees Samit one, which was a great bit of defending. Obviously he's got the gas to do it. There was that one from Bigger as well. It is definitely things like that that give you encouragement, because that was not on show at the end of the Italian game, which was weak falling off tackles, thinking, we'll probably get through this.
So you look,
you're absolutely right. There are positives in there, and Tommy Rafael is probably as big a positive as you want. Just when you thought it was going to be, it couldn't get any harder to pick a back row.
I will say he did benefit yesterday from being in a properly balanced back row. He's got an out and out six, an out and out eight, and then he just plays seven, and that's his only role. Other boys who've had chances, like Jack Morgan and Tane Basham in the last season, have been in botched together back rows.
Seb Davis covering at six.
Two open
sevens,
sides and different things, and that's, you know, that can work, but it's not the same balance. And so Tommy's at it, you know, and he's also got to play in a side that was playing well, unlike the others who've played this year. So as ever, you know, people got very carried away with Tane Basham when he came into the side, generally in the media and around the way. And I try not to get too carried away with Tommy, but like when you watch him play for Leicester, he's a type of physique where, you know, obviously these boys are supreme condition. And there's, you know, there's veins hanging out their arms and their necks and their legs. But a bit like Alan Wynn, Tommy seems to have veins in his face. He's just got a craggy, gnarly, veiny face, which I don't know if that's the way you grade international forwards. But that
I'm pretty sure it is.
That is, I would have thought, promising sign that his face is absolutely fucking frightening.
I like to think that kind of like what Sean Edwards does. He's like, spotted this youngster. He's just veins popping out, veins where there shouldn't be veins.
That's you know, like different kind of player, I think. Well, no, very similar player. Sam Warburton, one of my good mates coached him at a young age, and just said, "Where you and I will have veins in our forearm, he's got that on his hip."
Yeah.
And on his love handles, you know, there's just
veins have got veins.
Yeah, there's just, and that's because they're obviously really strong, but very low body fat, so everything shows up, and they're just gnarly as fuck.
It was an impressive performance for sure. Right, as we head towards the end of this show, Murph, it can be prolonged no longer, and you just mentioned teams named after animals. We're going to move that slightly to teams named after mythical beasts, because Jamie Phillips, who genuinely I think has listened to this show since the very first one, has asked for my thoughts on the Dragons rebrand. And it gives me an opportunity to say that hopefully we're going to be speaking to David Buttress about it. So keep your ears peeled, if that is such a thing, for that. Or better still, make sure you subscribe to us, because you'll get a notification if we're able to get that interview. So that'd be good. Firstly, Murph, do you have any thoughts, or do you care about the Dragons rebrand in any way?
Look, we've talked about marketing being a weakness, but I think most of the regions have been through rebrands, probably several over the last 20 years.
I think all have been through at some point now.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, when I say rebrands, I mean rebrands, if you know what I mean, or makeovers. And that's fine. And, you know, like yes, it made the most salient point about marketing of the game in Wales. But that will only go so far. What it actually needs is to be fully funded, the region, and be competitive in terms of salary budget. Almost, I don't think we, like I said before, I don't think we need to be on a level playing field with the big spenders in the British Isles. But if we're just ballparking the same, if we look like we're playing the same sport in terms of how much money we spend, I think we will be not far behind them in terms of ability on the pitch. This I'm going off piece a little bit, but what I don't want to do with, if the budgets do go up in across the regions in Wales, what I don't want to do is just get more generous with the same players, because that's pointless. Because some as we've just, I think it came up in the last podcast we did before the end of the season, some players are overpaid now. Lots of players around the regions are overpaid for what they are, because they, you know. As we discussed, there's this banding thing where if they achieve so many caps, or if they play international rugby, they move up a banding, and they're on a substantial amount of money, and then they play against guys over the border in Europe or wherever, and they can't hold the scrum against them, and the guy who's stuffing them is probably on half or 60-70% of what the our boy is on. So that banding thing needs to be looked at, and we don't need to get more generous with the boys of the year. We need to get more business-like with the boys of the year. They're already here, and then bring in the really top quality that we used to, really top quality imports that we used to have 15 years ago.
But what I really want to know is, would those players look better with a fleur-de-lis crest with Dragons ROC written above it?
But listen, if it catches on with the kids and the kids buy loads, then it's been worth it. It depends how much someone got paid to come up with that rebrand, obviously.
I shall pass that question on to Mr. Buttress if we manage to secure his time. But yeah, look, from what I think about it, because I've kind of got two hats on this. One is a professional hat, having worked in marketing, sports marketing, and that's a very boring hat, because it kind of says, right, what does the research say? What, you know, how much research have you got behind the rebrand to suggest this is what, you know, this is the direction you should be heading? The other part that's probably a bit more interesting is the fans hat, which everyone seems to have an opinion, and that's what it comes down to. That's the important bit, is how much more likely is it to get you to go and watch a game. And I suppose the problem I have, and this is the problem with the regions full stop, is it kind of sits somewhere between Newport, which some people were kind of thinking, right, Cardiff have gone back to Cardiff, or are you going to go back to Newport? And obviously a lot of people who are perhaps disenfranchised with regional rugby generally might latch on to Newport for a bit, but then they too get pissed off if we lose every home game, you know, and have a season like Cardiff did. Because it's not like, you know, I think, you know, maybe that rebrand for Cardiff is the right thing, but it doesn't solve anything unless you're able to back it up on the pitch, and that is the important thing. I like the fact that, you know, there's a bit more of a reference to kind of Gwent or Monmouthshire on there, because to me it's just like I'm just a bit cynical and fed up, like you say, of teams named after bloody animals or mythical beasts. It's like, I don't, you know, I know Gwent is a, you know, it's a thing at least, right? If I was explaining the game to my mother-in-law, as often happens, and she says, what rugby are you watching today? And I try and explain that what Dragons versus Benetton is, and I can't. It's a lot easier to get people to go and see. I go, oh, it's Gwent versus Leicester, right? And to say, where's Gwent? And I'll say, oh, it's in South Wales. And that you can kind of explain.
Your mother-in-law wants it. Where's Gwent?
She would. No, probably would. Yeah. She probably would. She's from Liverpool. I don't think she'd be necessarily as familiar with the historic counties of South Wales. But anyway, I don't know. For me, that's kind of something you can buy into. And, you know, either Gwent or Monmouth, it's a place. I would just like teams to be named after places for a change. But it's harder to do in Wales because we've got a fudged regional system. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So they're called the Gwent Dragons.
No, they're now just called Dragons RFC.
Oh.
But I'm suggesting.
Oh, I see. Right. Yeah.
In my eyes, I think it should be called Gwent Dragons. Probably should have been what they were called from the start, but they haven't. And frankly, now I'm just like, I just want to see a team based out of Newport that's competitive.
Well, look, let's be honest. The name is the least. Again, to the point where the name is the least important aspect of it. We just need them to be competitive. We need at least two of our regions to be able to make it into the top half of the table, the domestic table. That's a start. From there, then we can talk about maybe holding our own in Europe. At the moment, we've got every region in the bottom half of the table because they haven't got enough money to compete with all the teams they play against.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you know what? I think that's the thing, is it makes a lot of... I'm not saying that branding's not important, because it is, but it's not. Yeah. It's not a fix-all. It's not a fix-all thing, you know. It's but what does fix things... the branding is almost like the curtains, you know, it's like the front door, it's the front of house. You've got to have everything in order behind
it. But we're getting into the realms of, I think, I don't know if I'm imagining this, but there's some like American sports teams in whatever franchise in whatever sport where they're so terrible that becomes part of their franchise, that part of their marketing. Come and see the
Cleveland Browns, they're a bad team, aren't they?
Yeah. Or just a minor league team, which is one in seasons, and that becomes part of the thing. And next thing you know, there's a load of headbangers who turn up because they just want to be cult fans behind this awful team. And that kind of gathers moss. And it doesn't result in that side being any good, but the marketing works, and the next thing you know, they got a really loyal following, and everything goes better for them. But we're into the realms of, come and see these absolutely shite underfunded teams get stuffed by far superior sides and have a laugh while you're doing it. That's how far down we're looking at the moment.
What I would say to that is the hardy souls that go and watch the Dragons on the Hazel stand when it's pissing down with rain and we're losing have obviously bought into that without it being marketed that way. And fair play to them for doing so. But I just think, look, if we started winning games and playing half decent again, I think enough time has passed with the names and things like that that Newport fans who there will be people who never want to engage with it, and I get it. But I think there will be people who are not bothered, who live in Newport, who would start going again if they were playing well. And likewise, I think there are similar people in Gwent who, you know, other parts of Gwent, who would go and start watching them if they were playing well. But, you know, that's where it comes down to. You've got to get a half competitive team.
Yeah, I mean, like we said before, the type of people they need to attract to get into rugby now can't even remember before regional rugby anyway. You know, it's 20-year-old, nearly 20-year-old. And so the type of people, the school kids and the people in their 20s can't remember, the hardcore rivalries of village to village back in the day.
The academy players can't. Some of the first team can't remember those days. So it's like, and that's the interesting thing, actually. And well, I say interesting. I think it's interesting. I was chatting yesterday to my brother-in-law's dad, and he's... he used to go and watch Newport RFC every, pretty much season ticket holder, and really, really liked it. And he's kind of, again, it might go now and again to watch the Dragons, but was very much a Newport fan first. But the thing I did say was actually is like, if you take a look at that team sheet now, it's full of lads from the area. Mm. You know, it is now. Whereas when Newport were good in the 90s, when I used to watch them, There were local players, but our best players were South Africans.
And it was like a Canadian invitational side as well sometimes.
Yeah, it was South Africans, Canadians, and brilliant imports. Mm. And it was brilliant and it was wonderful. Mm. But there is something, I would just love to see this side get competitive, because I love looking at the amount of players who are from Newport and surrounding towns and villages who actually... have gone on to play for Wales and do stuff, even though they're playing for a side that's been rubbish for a decade. So, you know, I don't know. I would love it to work for that reason. And I think you can, again, to bring it back to marketing, if you've got a side full of local lads that go on and even just start being competitive, that is something to be proud of. Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. I hope it goes that way.
Probably mention, because we haven't been on air since. Is
I was gonna, yeah.
But you carry on being professional. I'll just swear a lot.
No, it's been obviously the our first show since Phil Bennett died, and Murph, as a man much more knowledgeable about rugby than I am, and rugby history. It's hard actually to sum up how important a player and a character Phil Bennett is, really.
Yeah. I mean, the earliest I can remember watching anything on TV is 1978, and he retired from international rugby in 1978. So when I started going to watch Cardiff as a kid, he was just about finishing. So I might have seen him play in the flesh once, but I would have been 7 or 8. So, it's on the limit of my memory as well, but his name carries over generations and international borders as well. I tell you what I found strange at the time is just after he'd passed away, I had to go to Kidwelly area. I was taking my mother down there. And that beautiful carving they've done of him is right by the road in Velinvore. So I was driving through Velinvore to go to Kidwelly, and I looked to my right and it's literally 10 yards away from me and nearly crashed the bloody car. I don't know why, I just thought he was in Parkland, you know what I mean, away from the road. Mm. So it's, I'd imagine us had a lot of visits over the last few weeks, that carving. Obviously that we're in that era now where all the 70s names are getting to be seriously old men. So we've already, I think, Phil is the latest, but it was John Dawes, wasn't it, last year?
It was.
And so fingers crossed they all make it to 95.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just, I don't know, it's that folklore thing, isn't it, that's amazing. So yeah, obviously, I am a bit younger than you. So, the first games I remember watching were in the early 90s. So, Phil Bennett was long finished by then. But, the legacy, I like I say, I think I probably watched that VHS, was it called the...
Oh, Wales' well, greatest 101 tries, yeah. Or something.
No, yeah. It was specifically about the 70s.
All right.
And it was just incredible. I mean, my brother had it, and he said, right, watch this. And it was more fun than watching us in the 90s. And it was just
they were big sellers in the 90s, because there was nothing,
yeah, they were.
There was nothing to see on the
Everyone
thing.
Had a copy.
Yeah.
But that's it. It was, it's just that the way that these players played the game was so... I know we romanticise these things, but it was just the way that rugby should be played, and is most beautiful, and the style that the team had. And again, Bennett was just at the absolute heart of that. And speaking to people, like my dad's mates who really, really knew their rugby, telling me just how good Bennett was, because again, as a kid, you're drawn to Barry John at points in that, and obviously another player with an amazing legacy. But it's just talking through the things that Bennett could do, and the way that he played the game, and the spirit and the enterprise. You just thought, God, how can you not buy into this almost like cult of how important this man was.
Yeah.
And you think stepping into those shoes as well. Barry John retired at what, 27, 28?
Yeah.
Stepping into those shoes, first for club and then for country.
That's the weird thing. Only Wales in the 70s could replace Barry John with Phil Bennett.
With Phil Bennett,
I mean, unbelievable. I mean, when people talk about the greatest ever or pick a dream team, invariably from wherever they are in the world, if they're old enough, obviously there's a certain generation who looks at Dan Carter or John Wilkinson because they can't remember that far back. But it's difficult to choose between the two, and to just suddenly, you know, King Barry retires at a ridiculously young age, and you just got this young kid appears, you know, and just carries on like nothing's changed. And I know it's very hypothetical. What if Barry John had decided to carry on for 5 years? You'd have had the two of them.
Long before the days of tactical substitutions and things like that, you know, I don't know, maybe Benny would have been the Chico Hopkins of that position. Yeah. But it's, I mean, as it was, what a history to write. And I remember reading his autobiography as well, and, you know, talking about how difficult that, is it the 77 tour to New Zealand, the one he captained? Because again, you know, so many of that 74 side are then gone, and to then go to New Zealand and try and recreate it. But the strength of character to be able to, you know, to be able to do that, and
worth reiterating, I know it's a different era, but on the back of being absolutely tiny in the flesh, you know, it's touch and go whether he looks more like a out of shape jockey than an actual rugby player. He was a tiny man, like, you know. I've actually, anyone who's played against Felin Boyle has actually played in front of Phil Bennett, because he was there for every game, and if you were winning, he'd leave early and be muttering under his breath. It's just a good sign, I suppose, from our point of view. But he was much like Graham Price. Graham Price is still watching club rugby every Saturday, and when I was in youth level, I would see him around clubs still playing in 1990, 1991. He'd still be playing games. So they're all those boys are just rugby through and through, you know. I guess a little bit like Alan Bateman playing in his 40s. They just love the game, and just because they're no longer internationals, on no longer at their peak, doesn't mean they're not going to be involved heavily with rugby anymore.
Absolutely. And obviously the sad news that Phil Bennett is gone definitely won't detract on the legacy that he's left on the game, not even just the game in Wales, you know, the game of rugby as a whole, you know, his footprint will be all over that for a very, very long time. Obviously the sad note to finish on. But thanks to everyone for listening to these. We're going to be back again next week. We'll be doing these shows throughout the summer series, and then we're going to put Murph on another training run. We'll look to hunt down Dan Killick, hide outside his house, and chuck him in the back of a van and force him to do a podcast.
Things must be bad if he can't even roll himself out for an international weekend.
I know.
Things must
I know.
Be bad. It must be. He must be flogging houses in Monaco or something. It's just too high roller for us now.
Yeah, this is it. Yeah, no. Yeah, even he would normally grace us with his presence for an international. But yes. Anyway, we'll be back next week. Thanks for listening. And as always, if you fancy leaving us a review, you can do that on Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. That would be really appreciated. And finally, thanks to our sponsors at So Coffee Trades. If you want to get some top quality coffee, support a fledgling Welsh business that's going from strength to strength, then you can do that too by going to socoffeetrades.co.uk. Thanks for listening.
Sports Social Podcast Network.